Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where I, Rich Lowry, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal and national security issues. This week, what else? The Steve Bannon trial and the latest from the January 6th committee. You are, of course, listening to a National View podcast. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And please give this podcast and Andy McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, 5-star reviews they deserve on iTunes. Now, without further ado, I welcome to this very podcast, through the miracle of Zoom, none other than Andy McCarthy.
Rich, how are you?
Good, Andy. How are you?
I'm fine. I just did an interview with Ross Kaminsky in Denver.
Okay.
And yeah, very good guy. And but besides telling me to say hello to you, he wanted to know, how on earth is it that the editor of National Review does not get his name on the marquee for this podcast?
Well, I'm just the facilitator. I'm just a metaphorical we, Andy, not a real we.
Well, he gave me a chance to tell our fans in Denver more about the podcast, and was a very good guy about like sort of hyping it for us. So
spread the word. So as we speak here, recording earlier in the week than we usually do, we're on a Thursday again, which we did last week as well. Usually it's Friday, but here we are sitting Thursday afternoon. The Bannon trial looks like it's beginning to draw to a close. So let's dive into that first. So he's indicted for contempt of Congress.
That's right. And this is breaking news in the last few minutes, Rich. This is early afternoon, as you say, on Thursday. And I have to say that Steve becomes probably the 8 zillionth defendant in the history of prosecutions who had a lot to say on the courthouse steps, but didn't quite make it that last 20 or 30 feet to the witness stand. So his lawyers announced today that he will not be testifying. They will not be presenting a defense. So even as we speak, they could be gearing up for closing arguments, which I think will be pretty quick.
So what happened here? So that the committee subpoenaed him and he refused, and then the committee refers him, and then DOJ prosecuted him.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's contempt of Congress had not been indicted by the Justice Department in close to 40 years until they indicted Bannon for it. And it's not like there hasn't been contempt of Congress in the meantime. We remember, for example, just in the Obama years, the scandal over Fast and Furious, that ATF gun walking scandal, the IRS harassment of the conservative organizations. There was a lot of obstruction of Congress. There was a lot of lying to Congress. In fact, I think Eric Holder became the first attorney general ever to be held in contempt of Congress during that era, during the Fast and Furious investigation. But there was no prosecutions of anyone. Now, you wouldn't expect it when the people who Congress is complaining about are in the same administration and the same party as the executive branch. You wouldn't expect the executive branch to be tripping over themselves to do that. And of course, Democratic administrations never appoint voluntarily special counsels to look into scandals that happen in Democratic administrations. But even when you had mixed government with the Congress and whether it's the same government or mixed government between Congress and the executive branch from a partisan standpoint, this is just not something that's done. And there's good institutional reasons for that. There were a handful of prosecutions, Rich, in the Watergate era, and nothing since the early 80s. And the reason for this is, even if an administration is the same party as Congress, the president is someday going to be a former president. And even when he's a current president, he's going to want to have a wide berth for the same kind of privileges and immunities from congressional scrutiny regardless of what party the president is in. And the Justice Department has guidance that goes back to 1971, written by someone we now know better as the late former Chief Justice William Rehnquist. But this was when he was a lawyer at the Justice Department, the head of the Office of Legal Counsel before Nixon put him on the Supreme Court. And Rehnquist wrote a fairly notorious memo in Justice Department circles that administrations from both parties have relied on in the half century since, which basically says Congress can't subpoena the president because that would be an obvious separation of powers problem. The framers very much didn't want the executive branch to be beholden to Congress. And for the same reason, you can't subpoena the president's top advisors, because effectively that's the same thing as subpoenaing the president in many ways. So they take the position, and Rich, this is beyond executive privilege, which relates to communications with the president. The Justice Department takes the position that the president and his top officials have absolute immunity from testimony. Now, as with everything Trump, this becomes controversial because there's all kinds of new situations that come up that never have come up before. So in connection with January 6th, we have for the first time ever a president who is a former president trying to invoke executive privilege, which, believe it or not, there's some Supreme Court authority for the proposition that a former president can do that. And of course, there's this Department of Justice guidance that's out there as well about the president and his top advisors. But in this instance, the incumbent president, because it's Trump and it's January 6th, so Trump is always different, January 6th is always different, the incumbent president is not supporting Trump's invocation of privilege and is not extending to Trump officials the same, the same guidance. So the court is dealing, to the extent this has been a judicial issue at all, the court has had to deal with the novel question of what do you do when the president, who's a former president, tries to assert these privileges, but the incumbent objects, which hasn't ever happened before. And I do think Biden will come to regret it, because he'll want, he'll want sweeping privilege, both if the Republicans take over Congress, which is likely to happen next year, and also when Biden's out of office and when Biden officials are out of office. They're basically, if you go to war the way they're doing, that, as we've seen in a number of contexts, that kind of tends to blow up in your face. But in any event, they decided to go after Bannon. They've actually tried to go after four officials. They've gone after Bannon. When I say they've gone after him, what I mean is the committee, on the basis of either not enough cooperation or no cooperation at all, the committee has referred to the Justice Department four Trump officials for prosecution: Bannon, Mark Meadows, who was Trump's chief of staff, Dan Scavino, who was the deputy press officer, I think, and Peter Navarro, who was a White House advisor mainly on tariffs. So it's interesting. The Justice Department has indicted two of them and declined to indict two of them. Bannon was indicted, and I think the line they're drawing is at the time that Bannon was charged, he had not been a Trump official for 3 years. He couldn't claim that he was a high-ranking official. The Justice Department declined to prosecute Mark Meadows and Dan Scavino, and I think the bright line there is they clearly were high Trump officials who would have been covered by the Justice Department guidance. The interesting one that we'll have to watch going forward, and we'll have to see how this case develops, is Navarro. So the committee asked for Navarro to be indicted for contempt because he told them to go pound sand. He wouldn't agree to give them any information or any testimony. Claimed protection under the Justice Department guidance. And what the Justice Department appears to have reconciled in that situation is that even though Navarro was a high-ranking official or a high advisor to Trump with respect to tariffs, what they want to ask him about is this memo that he wrote around the time of the Stop the Steal stuff, which rehashed all of the Stop the Steal claims, including a bunch of them that had already been debunked at that point. So I think the Justice Department is taking the position that even though he was a high advisor to the president, this what they want to ask him about was outside his official portfolio, which was about tariffs. I think that's a terrible mistake to draw a line like that, but we'll see. We'll have to see how it works out.
And Bannon chose to go to trial on this just because he's his whole affect is on the fighter, you know, honey badger doesn't care or whatever. So I'll just take this and take the hit rather than give in to the deep state.
Yeah. Well, you know, look, I think there's a lot of that going on. And I think part of what's going on also is he may have relied too much on the assumption that Trump still had two things. The assumption that Trump still had the legal authority to assert executive privilege. And secondly, that even if Trump did have that authority, that it could apply to Bannon. So, you know, what happened with Bannon was he gets in October of 2021. So this is after the committee is all up and running. They give him what they've given most of the Trump people that they've tried to subpoena, which is they give him a subpoena for in-person testimony, which means he would have to come in and be deposed. And secondly, a subpoena for relevant documents that he's got. And Bannon basically tells them to pound sand. He's not going to produce anything. And what he tells them is that he understands that Trump has asserted executive privilege and has instructed that Bannon should not cooperate with the committee. Now, Trump had asserted executive privilege with respect to Trump's personal presidential records that are held in the National Archives. And he had made, you know, this is like we saw this throughout Trump's presidency, Rich, right? Where he tweets things that he wants to convey as messages to people, but he doesn't do the formal steps that you have to do as president to actually give an order, right? So he's publicly out there saying, this committee is just, you know, it's the unselect committee and it's a witch hunt and all the old Mueller lines. But behind the scenes where the legal stuff is going on, he's got one litigation where he goes into the courts of Washington, D.C. and tries to get the committee barred from getting his records at the National Archives. And then otherwise, he's telling his underlings from his administration not to cooperate with the committee. But how hard he's telling them that behind the scenes is hard for us to know. So Bannon suggests that he gets this sweeping authorization from Trump not to cooperate with the committee. And then it turns out, and this ended up being important in the last rounds of pretrial litigation in the case, the FBI interviewed Trump's lawyer, who supposedly was involved in negotiations or instructions to Bannon about what he was allowed to do. And what the lawyer said was that Trump never asserted executive privilege as to Bannon in a specific way. Like he never told him, don't discuss this, don't discuss that. You're supposed to be exacting on this. You know, Steve was taking the position that Trump said executive privilege, so I don't have to do nothing. I'm not showing up. I'm not giving you a shred of paper. And in fact, what's supposed to happen here is, you know, question by question, you're supposed to tell the committee whether you're asserting a privilege or not. And there was a lot that the committee wanted to go into with Bannon that didn't have anything to do with executive privilege and probably wasn't covered by anything Trump could confer. So Bannon was trying to use the impression that Trump had issued a blanket invocation of executive privilege to excuse him from any cooperation at all. Trump's lawyer told the FBI that Trump never told Bannon not to cooperate at all, or that anything that Trump was telling Bannon authorize complete noncompliance. So now how much of, you know, I mean, these are conversations that go on between the lawyers, right? And it would have been interesting if Bannon testified, because that would have opened up question, you know, communications between Bannon and Trump. And for some reason, Rich, I don't know why, I have a feeling that the conversations between Bannon and Trump may not be entirely mirrored by the conversations between the lawyers for Bannon and Trump. But in any event, the record is that Trump may not have asserted executive privilege at all. And then the other, with respect to Bannon. And then the other problem is, as the matter of law, there's a question of how much executive privilege Trump has in a situation where the incumbent president, Biden, is objecting to Trump's assertion of privilege, or at least is not supporting it, which is not a situation that's ever obtained before. And a lot of this confusion goes back to this Watergate era case, Nixon against administrator, in which the Supreme Court, in an opinion by Justice Brennan, kind of by and by said that, you know, former presidents retained some measure of executive privilege, although the court didn't describe what that measure was. And it's understandable that you could see that, because it doesn't, whether a president is currently president or is in a post-presidency, at the time that decisions have to be made, if people think that they're not able to give the president, you know, frank advice, because the minute the president's out of power, Congress is going to start investigating and everybody's going to be thrown in a congressional hearing or a grand jury, that's going to be very bad for the executive branch. So you can see why you would want to continue to protect at least some measure of executive privilege in a post-presidency. But, you know, this is another way that, like, the craziness of the Trump presidency, particularly at the end, has kind of shocked the system and forced us to confront things that were never issues before.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go to the January 6th committee tonight, I guess it is. It's the prime time finale for the committee, and they are going to attempt to do a TikTok on what Trump was doing after the riot got underway and was unspooling for a couple hours.
Yeah, that's right. I think they've said now, Rich, it's something like 187 minutes. Is that what they're, I think, you know, from the beginning to the point where, you know, he finally took some action and people started to disperse, there's about 3 hours of time. It's either a little over or a little under 3 hours. So what the committee is building up to is that they want to, as you say, do a TikTok for that period of time, but they're going to do it in a thematic way, so that the theme tonight is dereliction of duty. And this again brings me back to what we've talked about a number of times before, which is, I was very critical, and I think most of us at National Review were very critical at the time that the impeachment was going on, of saying that they'd done a much better job writing up articles of impeachment and investigating. You know, once it was clear that Trump was not going to be removed from office while he was still in office, and that you were not in a big rush to get the impeachment done, because the trial in the Senate was going to be in his post-presidency anyway, there was no reason not to do a thorough investigation and write accurate articles of impeachment. They didn't do that. And my big beef at the time was, I thought that the biggest thing that was obvious that Trump did wrong was the dereliction of duty in connection with responding to the riot when it happened. And it was astonishing to me that they never charged that as an article of impeachment. So, and not only was it astonishing to me and to a lot of other people, by the time the impeachment trial happened in the Senate, weeks later, it's like the Democrats suddenly realized, oh, we have a hole in our case, and then tried to prove up dereliction of duty, even though they hadn't charged it in the impeachment article. So they even understood that this was a dereliction on their part not to have done that. So anyway, this committee continues to be the impeachment investigation that was never done 18 months ago. And it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that they think, you know, for their big finish where they want to make the biggest impact and the biggest impression, they're picking out the thing that they should have picked out in the first place, which was, what was he doing in those hours when the riot was going on? And there's definitely, Rich, going to be a military cast to what they're doing tonight. I think that suggests to us that a lot of this is going to have to do with, why didn't the National Guard respond to what was going on when it was clear that the security for the civilian security forces were overwhelmed? And very pointedly tonight, the committee members who are going to run the questioning are Adam Kinzinger and Elaine Luria, who's a Democrat from Virginia. We talked about Kinzinger a lot. Kinzinger was an Air Force pilot in Iraq, combat pilot. Elaine Luria was in the Navy for 20 years. I think she retired as a commander. And the big witness tonight, who we've already seen some videotape deposition testimony from, is Matthew Pottinger. Pottinger was the deputy national security advisor in the last stages of the Trump administration. He's an extraordinarily impressive guy, a combat Marine for 3 years in Afghanistan and Iraq, and national security advisor at the end of the Trump administration. And he's the one who very pointedly, in the testimony we've already seen, said that as soon as he saw Trump's tweet about Pence, he decided to resign. And he was gone that night. He didn't feel like he could responsibly drop everything he was doing and walk out the door. So he finished a couple of things he had to do that day, and he was gone because he wouldn't work for him anymore after that. So, you know, they're obviously fronting all these military people. And I think it's going to be a big issue that the commander in chief didn't do anything while the seat of government was under siege.
So we'll know more tonight. So there's not too much reason to speculate, but I'll ask you to speculate anyway. So would we assume Pottinger, you know, China expert, would have been privy to what was going on in response to this event at the Capitol?
Yes. There's no doubt, because we've already, I mean, you would figure this anyway, right? But there's already been testimony about the National Security Council, which the National Security Advisor and Deputy are part of, that they were following this in real time. In fact, if you remember back the testimony of Cassidy Hutchinson, where they were talking about the fact that Trump wanted to be taken from the Ellipse directly to the Capitol because he told people he was going to march to the Capitol. Her testimony and what the committee said based on records that they had gotten over the last few months is that the National Security Council was watching this in real time and thought that the Secret Service, that the decision had already been made that the Secret Service were going to take Trump to the Capitol, that the only thing that was left to decide was what would be the best route. So there's no question that they were following this and he was getting updates on it. And Pottinger's testimony that we've already seen, the videotape deposition testimony, is that as soon as Trump did the Pence tweet, one of Pottinger's subordinates on the National Security Council came to him and said, "This just got tweeted." So he was obviously getting updates about what was going on. And it makes, they're in the White House and there's a riot at the Capitol. You know, obviously everybody in there, and certainly anybody who had a job that was in any way related to U.S. national security, would have been on alert for that.
So we also have this controversy that I must confess I've only half, or to be honest, probably a quarter followed, over Secret Service texts that the committee wanted, and then but the Secret Service says were destroyed. What's going on with that?
Yeah. So, Rich, this is another thing that goes back to the Cassidy Hutchinson testimony and the most titillating part of it, which was this idea that Trump had had this physical altercation with his security team, which included Bobby Engel and at least one other agent who was the driver. Engel was the guy who, the Secret Service agent who was running the detail. And then Engel goes back to and reports to Tony Ornato, who's the Secret Service agent, who was the head of security at the White House. According to Cassidy Hutchinson, he reports to Ornato what happened in the skirmish with Trump in the car. And then Ornato comes to Meadows' office. Not clear that Meadows is there, but Ornato, in the presence of Engel, tells Hutchinson about Trump supposedly trying to grab the steering wheel and then getting into a minor physical altercation with Engel. So there's a lot of controversy about this because the committee elicited it from Hutchinson, even though she never said that she had seen it. She has a hearsay basis for hearing about it. They had access to Ornato and Engel, but they apparently didn't check the story with them before they had Hutchinson testify about it publicly. And then sources who were close to Ornato and Engel came out publicly and said that they were saying it never happened, that Engel and the agent who were driving the car were both willing to testify that Trump, that there was no altercation with Trump. And Ornato would go even further than that. Ornato was supposedly ready to testify not only that it didn't happen, but that he never told that story to Hutchinson, which would have been, I think, very damaging to her testimony if he credibly testified that way. P.S., they never testified. And, you know, for all this banter about Secret Service, what we heard not only was that all these people who said they were going to testify haven't testified, but there was also pushback from people who said that there was a lot of chatter among the Secret Service people that day, and that a lot of people knew that there had been this altercation with Trump and that something bad happened in that car, whether it was exactly the way Hutchinson described it or not. So one of the ways the committee thought that it would be good to go about this was, let's get the text. Let's find out what the Secret Service guys were talking about that day. And when that suggestion came up, it turned out that the Secret Service said, gee, we're really sorry about that. But turns out that, you know, we had this long planned changeover to a different system that we were doing in mid-January, just a few days after the riot, as it just happens to turn out. And what the agents were supposed to do was they were supposed to check all of their phones to see if they had any government business related texts. And if they did, they were supposed to upload those to an internal Secret Service drive. And they needed to do it by a date certain, because on that date, the system was going to be overhauled and everything on the phones was going to be erased. So P.S., the Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security says that after January 6th, he told Secret Service that they had to maintain all of their relevant texts and that they didn't do it. You know, the agents didn't upload it to the system, and Secret Service went ahead and erased everything anyway. And as a result of this news breaking, the committee issued a subpoena last week after their last hearing to Secret Service, telling them that they wanted all of the relevant text from that period of time. And Secret Service got back to the committee a couple of days ago and apparently told them that they had spent 4 days trying to reconstruct all of their information systems, but they were sorry to say that there's just nothing left. Everything appears to have been erased. So there are no existing texts that might shed light on what happened on January 6th.
So has the committee been seeking the testimony of the Secret Service officials who will supposedly dispute Hutchinson's account?
Not clear exactly where that's at. What Benny Thompson, the chairman of the committee, said was that, and he said this publicly, they are in contact and speaking to those agents. But he was very elliptical when asked, well, have they testified? Did you bring them back for new interviews? You know, have they corroborated the story? And, you know, he's very sketchy on that. And the other thing that we should bear in mind with this, Rich, is, you know, there was that reporting in the Times after Pat Cipollone was interviewed behind the scenes. We saw a lot of Cipollone's videotape deposition last week. We're probably going to see a lot more of it tonight, we're told. But the reporting in the Times, based not least on an interview with Zoe Lofgren, who is one of the senior Democrats on the committee, was that Cipollone had not contradicted Hutchinson, but it wasn't clear that the committee asked him about the things that were in dispute. And there was also some reporting in the Times that the lawyers for Cipollone and the lawyers for the committee met before the deposition happened, and Cipollone let it be known that there were things he would not corroborate Hutchinson on. And the reporting was that they just didn't ask him. So I got some pushback from people when I wrote that, basically saying, you know, these are Cipollone's people. They're out there trying to work people. And, you know, they did ask them. And the Times article is not accurate. You know, I heard all kinds of stuff. But when I asked, well, then why don't they just put the transcripts out? You know, why do we have to play this stupid game? If they can bring Cassidy Hutchinson in and have her testify publicly, then just put the transcripts out. And, you know, we don't need the, I don't need Maggie Haberman. I'm happy to read a transcript, you know, but they haven't put transcripts out. So to the extent that people are wondering if they're playing games, my attitude, Rich, is when you're playing games, people are going to wonder whether you're playing games. You know?
Yeah. So one goal here has been to build a prosecutable case against Trump. We can discuss that in more detail at some point, but you know, whether Merrick Garland's going to go there. But we do have increasing signs that this Georgia prosecution effort is quite serious. So what's the latest in that, with that element?
Yeah, I think this is really disturbing, Rich. Now, I don't think it's at all disturbing that they're investigating it. And I think, you know, it's a fact of life, especially when you're looking at prosecutions in a political context, and especially when you're looking at district attorneys, which tends to be an elected position around the country rather than an appointed one. There's going to be some political overlay. So I have not dismissed out of hand that the Georgia investigation is a hyper-political investigation just because the district attorney there, whose name I think is Fannie Willis, you know, just because she's a Democrat doesn't mean that it's necessarily a partisan investigation. At the same time, you know, it's obviously one that she's trying to draw a lot of attention to. So it's been very public in recent days that she subpoenaed Lindsey Graham, very unusual in a state criminal investigation to try to subpoena a United States senator. And also, you know, the murderer's row of the, you know, the Trump advisory kitchen cabinet, you know, Rudy, John Eastman, Jenna Ellis, others. So all those people have been subpoenaed in connection with this Georgia investigation. And what it seems to home in on is the fake electors scheme, or at least what the committee has called the fake elector scheme. And I have to say, the Trump electors in Georgia have objected indignantly to the suggestion that they were fake electors. And I actually think now, having read their legal objections to what the DA is doing, that there's a lot to what they're saying. What they're saying is December 14th was the drop dead date. December 14th of 2020 was the drop dead date for the Electoral College. In other words, that was the date. Actually, under federal law, it was December 8th when people was supposed to be the deadline for raising objections. But if you overlook that, December 14th is the day the Electoral College meets. So their position was, if, and this was Eastman's original position, was that we're in court in Georgia challenging the election. And we've raised a bunch of grounds for them to throw out the election results. While that litigation is going on, we need to get electors for Trump lined up.
There you go.
Because if we win the case in court, but we failed to get electors picked by December 14th, then what Congress could end up saying is we've waived the right to have electors from Georgia. So what the Georgia electors, these people who agreed to be Georgia electors, what they're saying is, you know, look, we're the people who were going to be the Electoral College for Georgia if Trump won Georgia. So the only thing we did here is we said on a contingent basis, if Trump wins the litigation in Georgia, as of December 14th, we stand ready to be the Trump electors, the slate of Trump electors. So they always took the position that this was completely contingent on Trump winning the litigation that was ongoing in Georgia. So fast forward beyond December 14th, apparently in the late December, early January stage, Eastman and Rudy allegedly came up with this idea that Trump could sell to Pence, that he could choose the electors who had been contingently picked as the actual electors. So that if, for example, if they could get Republican members of Congress, members of the House and at least one senator to object to Georgia's electors, that they could convince Pence to recognize this alternative slate. And what these electors in Georgia are saying is, and I should say at that point, Rich, the committee is portraying that agreement between Rudy, Eastman, and Trump to try to sell that idea to Pence as part of the fraud conspiracy that they talk about with respect to the fake electors. So now go back to the fake electors who say they're not fake, but contingent. They say, if you look at what we signed, we never said anything other than we were contingent on based on what happens in this litigation. And if it turns out that Giuliani and Eastman and Trump put their little heads together and came up with some other scheme, that's got nothing to do with us. We didn't say, recognize us in our contingent role. All we said was if Trump wins the litigation, we stand ready to be the electors. And if they did that, they're not guilty of anything, obviously. And because that seems to be what the state of play is, when they originally spoke to the district attorney in Fulton County, the district attorney told them, we do not regard you as subjects or targets of the investigation. You're just witnesses. So then what happens is the January 6th committee has their hearing. And in the interim, the district attorney in Georgia got some of these fake electors / contingent electors to come in to be interviewed voluntarily on the representation that they were just witnesses. They're not potential defendants. So a couple of them, I think three of them went in and were interviewed. After the January 6th committee does their song and dance about the fake electors, the district attorney in Fulton County changes her position and tells the electors that they're now targets of the grand jury investigation. And even though the law is prosecutors are not supposed to subpoena targets of a grand jury investigation, because you're not supposed to intentionally get somebody to take the Fifth Amendment. When you tell someone they're a target of an investigation, that means they are likely to be charged criminally. So there's no point in putting them in the grand jury because you put them, they're already on notice that they could, anything they say could help build the case against them. So the bottom line here is it looks like what happened is the district attorney changed her position and told these people that they're now targets of the investigation and then subpoenaed them, even though she's not supposed to subpoena them into the grand jury, because they're trying to get them to take the Fifth. And as we've seen, in the January 6th committee hearings, if you take the Fifth, what the committee says is you're guilty. That by taking the Fifth is basically an admission of guilt, and you're trying to hide your guilt. And they stoke this in order to try to fill the atmosphere with the idea that they've proved the crime. And right. The only thing that's left is for somebody to admit to it, but everybody's taking the Fifth. So it's a scummy thing to do. And I, having said that, I'll admit the only thing I've read here is I've read the press coverage and I've read the legal submission of the electors. So if there's another side to the story, I'm happy to see it. And if it turns out that I'm wrong, I'll report back on it. But it looks to me like this is the kind of stuff the prosecutor shouldn't do.
So in brief time left here, let's hit some action in Congress related broadly to all of this, which is reform of the Electoral Count Act. A lot of us think that this is the thing that Congress can do to tighten up the system that would make the most difference. You have a bipartisan proposal on the table. What do you think of it?
I like it. And I am I'm the naysayer at National Review. I'm the one who says that, you know, if you open this can of worms, you're just going to let the Democrats do all the crazy stuff they want to do. Like Jamie Raskin wants to get rid of the Electoral College and all that stuff. So I come at this jaded and skeptical, even though I think Dan McLaughlin has written as the best stuff that you could read on the pro side. And it looks to me, we have a very good piece on the site from Yuval Levin about this today. It looks like it's a good proposal, Rich. I mean, what they would do is they would change the rule so that now instead of one member of the Senate and one member of Congress being necessary to object, you'd have to have 20% of both houses. Mm-hmm. So it would be a much higher bar in order to get an objection. So at least in theory, it wouldn't be frivolous. You'd have to have a good enough objection that it would draw, I don't know, 20 senators and 85 or so members of the House, right?
Off the top of your head, do you remember how many objectors there were in the House?
I think it was over 100.
Okay.
This time.
So
what, and there were
special.
Yeah, and there were senators who were willing to object. But, you know, they were very cagey. This was the Ted Cruz plan where Ted wouldn't come out and say that, you know, there was fraud. He basically said questions have been raised. And their point was that they wanted to have like call a 10-day pause so that there could be an investigation into fraud, even though he wouldn't come out and say there was evidence of fraud, especially when the Justice Department was saying there wasn't. But anyway, I think, you know, the idea of 20 senators and, you know, I think this thing, there's never been a situation before where 140 or whatever it was members of the House or over 100 members of the House were willing to do something like this. So if you had a bar where you needed 85 to make an objection, I think, Rich, I have to say, I thought that a lot of the January 6th stuff was play acting. I think you probably agree with me about this. I think they knew they couldn't win. So it was cost-free. You know, this was going to be rejected. They didn't have the votes for it. So they were playing to the MAGA crowd because they're all hoping that they're going to inherit those voters and their very vigorous support for the people that they back. But yeah. I think, you know, they just figured this was cynical. They weren't actually going to knock out any electoral votes, and they knew that. So it was just play acting. But In any event, I think raising it to something where, you know, if 20 senators and 85 members of the House want to back an objection, that's at least potentially something serious that rates being looked at. Mm-hmm. I think the new legislation would make clear that only the governor of the state can communicate the electoral votes to the Congress, which would make it much less likely that you would get multiple slates of electors, or that even that like a second slate could claim that they had any legitimacy. And they'd make very clear that the vice president doesn't have the authority to not count votes. And I think the other thing they're talking about doing, Rich, which would be good, is streamlining the judicial challenge to electoral votes. So basically, if there, in order to get this done, if there were an objection that was worthy of being heard in federal court, it would go to a three-judge panel, and they would make a decision, and then it would go right to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. So instead of having this sort of scattershot litigation all over the country, which is on all different time frames and run by all different judges, which, by the way, that's going to happen anyway at the state level. But if you have federal claims, they would go to one place, and in theory, they would get decided much more quickly. And if something needed to go to the Supreme Court, it would get there faster. That doesn't mean the Supreme Court would take it, but it would at least get there faster.
Got it. And your view, basically, this could have been done without the January 6th committee. That points to this as its legislative purpose.
Yeah, it reminds me, Rich, of the remember we talked about the two Senate committees that did the big report on all the security failures?
Mm-hmm.
Where we got like a very thorough report that laid out all the things that all the places where the Capitol Police failed and the intelligence agency failed and the FBI failed. I just think that, and maybe this is just a hobby horse with me and I should just give it up at this point, but I just think it's very obvious that what happened here is this. There was no investigation before the impeachment. So these people were trying to do the impeachment investigation, and they also think that they're kind of a grand jury. And a congressional committee is not supposed to conduct a criminal investigation unless they're investigating impeachment, because then they're looking for high crimes and misdemeanors. But it's not Congress's job. It's an executive responsibility in our system to do criminal investigations. So what the committee has been trying to do is do a criminal investigation under a bunch of pretexts that they actually have a legislative purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're asked about what's the legislative purpose, they say, well, we have to look into the security failures. Well, no, that's already been done. I mean, it's not to say they can't, but it's not necessary. It's already been done. And now it's like the Electoral Count Act. And I must say, I'm very happy to see the Senate take this up, because again, what a number of people on the January 6th committee, including Jamie Raskin, want to do is get rid of the Electoral College and go to a national popular vote. So I just think the committee was not necessary for all these legislative purposes they claimed to be necessary for. They're trying to do a criminal investigation. They're trying to do an impeachment investigation. And all that stuff is just a lot of bunting around it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's all the time we have this week. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte. Thanks everyone for listening. And thank you, Andy McCarthy.
Thank you, Rich.